This is Latin Pulse, a weekly analysis of news and public affairs in Latin America. Brought to you in cooperation with American University's School of Communication in Washington, D.C. and Link TV. And now here's host, Rick Rockwell.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Latin Pulse. This week, the power of women in Latin America. With two women topping the ballot in Chile, we'll take a closer look. And we'll discuss progress in the peace talks over Colombia's long civil war. But first, Megan Eckhamel is here with our weekly review of news from around Latin America.
Looting is sweeping across Argentina in the midst of police force strikes. Violent mobs of looters have killed at least 8 people in 5 cities. The strikes have hit more than 12 cities. The strikes ended when police negotiated a deal to double the starting wage. Despite this, government officials claim the lootings were planned. Sergio Uribarri, the governor of Entre Ríos province, condemned the strikes and the looting.
It's clear that these crimes have no justification. There isn't a social situation to explain such vandalism.
Government officials blame the opposition for inciting the violence and chaos. They point to social media as the main coordination tool. Marijuana has a new home in Uruguay. This week, the country of 3 million people approved legislation to legalize the drug. The law regulates marijuana production, distribution, and sales. The Uruguayan government has 120 days to implement the Institute for the Regulation and Control of Cannabis. Uruguayans gathered in the streets as the government voted on the bill, showing their support for cannabis regulation. Many Uruguayans see the drug war's current tactics as futile. Supporters of the law say regulating the marijuana market will take the profits from the black market dealers, and the government will benefit from the $40 million a year industry. The Colombian government blames the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia for a terrorist attack on Saturday. The bomb exploded in the state of Cauca, and at least 9 people died. The rebel group, known as the FARC, has not claimed responsibility for the attack. The blast went off as residents were preparing for the farmers market that day. Food containers hid the bombs inside of a vehicle. President Juan Manuel Santos vowed to find the culprits. The attack is one of about 500 terrorist incidents from this year alone. We'll have more on the peace talks in Colombia later in this program. Even in death, South Africa's former President Nelson Mandela may have brought two longtime enemies together. Both U.S. President Barack Obama and Cuban President Raúl Castro spoke at Mandela's memorial this week. Obama took the occasion to shake hands with Castro, the first time U.S. and Cuban leaders have exchanged such a greeting in almost 14 years. The U.S. and Cuba severed diplomatic relations in 1961. As part of Cold War policies of the Eisenhower administration. For Latin Pulse, I'm Megan Eckhamel.
Thanks, Megan. This weekend, voters in Chile will pick their next president, and no matter their choice, the winner will be a woman. Former President Michelle Bachelet, the socialist candidate, leads the pre-election polls. She won in the first round of balloting last month, but failed to pick up a majority of the votes, so now Chile will hold a second round of voting this weekend. Her opponent will be conservative Evelyn Matei. With the return of a woman to the presidency in Chile, Latin America will have 4 women in presidential posts, including Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina, Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and Laura Chinchilla in Costa Rica. We asked Macarena Sais of the Washington College of Law at American University to assess what the Chilean elections mean for the power of women in Latin America.
What you see today is more women in their own right being elected and being considered as political personalities. And I think that it has to do with this idea that women can also be in the public sphere. Now, at the same time, The problems that you see is that these women who are coming to be political beings, they transform into these sort of gender-neutral personalities. So they don't come with a women's rights agenda in any way. Or if they do, it has to be very subtle, behind other rights that will be less threatening to the majority when they hear the message. So when you have socialist candidates, they talk about, you know, the workers' rights and the poor people and everything. But when you have a woman, she will not say, well, in women's rights, that's basically my platform, I'm a feminist. It will be subtle. Like Michelle Bachelet, of course, she is, no one has any doubt that she is a feminist. She, even now more so than in her first period, because she's coming from UN Women, right? And she did a wonderful job in the United Nations. But her women's rights.
And she ran the United Nations women's
UN, yeah, that's what I'm saying, that she came from UN Women. So it's clear that she is a feminist and that she has a women's rights framework. And we all hope that it will really show in her new government. But it's not part of one of the mainstream points of her candidacy to say we need to really secure, for example, abortion for women, because she knows that that's something that doesn't really go well. There have been other political candidates in Latin America whose polls have been harmed by when they have talked about abortion, for example. And what it's interesting is you have in Costa Rica, for example, and you have Chile, women who have been elected president. And not only that, but they've been running against, in Chile, they've been running against another woman, Evelyn Matei. And there was another third woman candidate who, with very little possibilities of being elected, but it was very powerful because it was a woman from the sort of, not from the political elite, but it's a woman, her name is Roxana Miranda, and she had all an agenda about workers' rights and the people's rights, and that everybody was right-wing at the end of the day in Chile, and that she was really representing the rights of the workers and the poor people, et cetera.
And did she have a point?
Oh, I think she did. I mean, it's pretty convincing when you hear her. And but what it's interesting is at the same time, in Chile and in Costa Rica is where you have a huge disparity in terms of income between female and male workers. And in Chile, it's one of the countries where women work less in Latin America. So there you have this contradiction of these women being strong women, political women who have basically been able to be presented to the world and to their own country as beyond gender specifics, and yet you have this same country being this country being grounded into this differentiation between what women should do and what men should do. And as a matter of fact, Roxana Miranda, she was a stay-home mom until her husband died, and then she had to go out and work. So, you know, she does have these traditional roles history behind her, which Michelle Bachelet, of course, she doesn't have. She's a single mother and a doctor, so she represents completely the opposite.
Evelyn Matei, who is the conservative and the underdog in the Chilean race, she also, though, projects in the same way this particular strength that's genderless, does she not?
Oh, absolutely. I think that even more so than Michelle Bachelet, who at least she's been very, always very open about her stand on women's rights. And I think that she has had to tone it down only for sort of marketing purposes or election purposes. But no one would doubt about her commitment to women's rights agenda. But with Evelyn Matei, it's a little bit trickier. She is a right-wing candidate. And although she's an economist and she's always been a strong woman, professional woman, educated, smart, I think that her ideas on the role of women may be less, at least publicly, differentiated than in the case of Michelle Bachelet.
She comes to this election as the former Minister of Labor in the country.
That's correct.
So that gives her some resonance on that particular topic. But how do their views of women differ between those two female candidates in Chile?
So I think that one of the major problems at the end of the day is reproductive rights. I mean, if you want to find common grounds, you will talk about violence. And of course, no one would say that somebody's in favor of women being subject to violence, but violence in a very traditional way. No one wants women to be beat up. However, you know, the roles of family and privacy, then we become with some sort of subtleties in terms of how we treat domestic violence. But the main ideological divide between women from the right and women who are, we would say, liberal, I guess, in the structure of the United States mentality, and more into the left wing in the structure
center
of
left.
The Latin American mentality, is the reproductive rights agenda. And the idea that women are good deciders at the end of the day. To me, the problem of abortion, it's not one of who will have an abortion or not, but who is the one who's entitled, who should be able to decide what to do at the moment of an abortion. And I think that's the major difference with Michelle Bachelet trying to push for an agenda where at least we can decriminalize abortion in Chile in the cases of rape and when the life of the mother is at risk, because Chile is one of those countries where since the 80s with Pinochet, all forms of abortion have been criminalized. And the other women who don't have this sensitivity in terms of the abortion rights agenda, and that I think it has to do with also this sort of this detachment with the problem of poverty. See, at the end of the day, those who really suffer the problem of criminalization of abortion are not the socioeconomic high classes of Chile or Nicaragua or El Salvador, but are the poor women.
If Bachelet wins, are we going to see a change in abortion in Chile?
Oh, I wish, but I don't really know. I mean, I hope that Bachelet is the president only, and as the U.S. knows very well in these political times, the executive branch is only one small portion of what politics is. And you have a lot of negotiations there, and one of the problems also that you have in Chile is you have a strong, strong Catholic Church. That it's a political player and an important political player. So I'm not really sure how abortion will play, even when we're talking about something so reasonable as to think about abortions of, 13-year-old girl who's being raped or a woman who has been diagnosed with cancer and she can't get chemotherapy because she's pregnant and the treatment will be refused to her because doctors can't put her life at risk with that, because that would be putting the life of the fetus at risk.
So because we don't track this every week, abortion absolutely, completely illegal in Chile.
Absolutely, yes. What it's interesting is that not many women are incarcerated for abortion, but the threat of being incarcerated and the mistreatment that they get in hospitals because of the suspicion that they may have been, they may be coming with a treatment of induced abortions, it's really bad. It's not as terrible as the situation that in certain parts of Mexico is happening or in El Salvador or Nicaragua, where it's getting really desperate for certain sectors of society, but it's still a very unfair and unequal situation where women, and when I'm saying unequal, I'm not saying only in terms of women versus men in general, but mainly poor women versus the rest. So this is a huge obstacle for women's autonomy because they are the ones who cannot get an abortion in cases that, as I said, are so critical as when their life is in danger.
I want to ask you about one other recent political race that dealt with politics in Honduras. Xiomara Castro de Zelaya just lost the race there, and even though the election is under some dispute, it's not likely that she's going to be the president. The Washington Post described her as a stalking horse for her husband. Is she more in the cast of what women running for president used to be in Latin America? Does she represent the past?
I don't know. It may be, I don't know specifically, because to in order to really give that affirmation, I really have to know more about Honduras. This requires some sort of knowledge, deep knowledge about the culture. I think that when you see, for example, Violeta Chamorro became Chamorro, though that was her husband's last name. So that gives you something that though she was elected on her own right, it did sort of had this idea that you had to have be attached to some public figure, male public figure.
Chamorro being different, and I remember that at the time she was seen in this traditional role as the mother and a weak president. But years later, many people will see her as, I think now, as the uniter of the country in a post-war state.
Yeah, absolutely. But and I also think that women who work in politics, who get involved in politics, are entering into a realm that it's masculine in its structure, in the way that it has been structured. So many times they do have to neutralize themselves in order to be successful. I'm not really sure if we can say that in the case of Samara, she represents the model of the past. And one of the problems that I think I see is that I think that the model of the present is still the woman who can balance home and work. Now, the other thing that it's interesting is that the women who've been successful in presidential candidacies, or maybe I'm just generalizing, but in the case of Bachelet, and I think in the case of Chinchilla was the same. Well, in case of Rousseff, they were ministers of they had political offices in the executive branch that were traditionally seen as masculine. So they were not the ministry of the women or the ministry of the social affairs, but they were. Bachelet was minister of defense and minister of health first, and then minister of defense. And Rousseff, I think she was the Minister of Energy. So that also, you know, it requires this sort of, we are beyond our roles as traditional women, but we don't necessarily bring to the office an idea of stripping away from these gender stereotypes. They can't afford to do that, I think, openly.
Thank you so much. Macarena Sáez of the Washington College of Law at American University, our guest today on Latin Pulse.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
This planet we call Earth, abundant with new food, new cures, new life. An amazing place. Please don't let it vanish without a trace. Call for your free World Wildlife Fund Action Kit with 10 simple things you can do to help leave our children a living planet. Call 1-800-CALL. WWF.
Welcome back to Latin Pulse. Depending upon how you measure it, next year will mark 50 years of struggle in Colombia's civil war. But since the summer of 2012, Colombia's government and leaders of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, have held substantive peace talks in Cuba. Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos visited Washington last week to discuss progress in those talks with President Obama. The Washington Office on Latin America, WOLA, supports the Colombian peace process. We asked one of WOLA's key experts on Colombia, Jimena Sanchez, to again give us her assessment of the conflict in Colombia and measures to resolve the civil war. We spoke to her at WOLA's offices in Washington, D.C., so you may hear some of the city's traffic in the background.
Well, these are the first peace talks where we've actually seen that some agreements have been put forward, despite the fact that there had been multiple talks with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia over the past 20 years. These are the first peace talks where we see that some agreements have been made. Now, the FARC and the Colombian government have said that nothing is agreed until everything's agreed. So in other words, that everything is beholden to a final review. And they haven't made what has been agreed so far completely transparent. However, two of the agenda items, one which was on rural land policy, and secondly on political participation, have moved forward. On the rural land policy, the agreements were very vague, and we still have yet to see what they actually came up with. But on the political participation, an agreement that basically took place in November and took about 5 months for them to agree to, which the reasons for delays are various. But in any event, actually were made somewhat public. And those are very important developments in the peace talk.
This is going to allow the FARC to become a political party if there is a peace.
Well, the FARC for many years wanted a constitutional assembly where they would basically rewrite Colombia's constitution, have a political party, and immediately take offices in the House of Representatives in Colombia. That, at this point in Colombian history, is perhaps impossible due to public perception and also due to the fact that the leading FARC leaders all are persons who have arrest warrants for narco trafficking as well as implicated in war crimes of all sorts. And the Colombian public opinion is not going to allow that. Secondly, Colombia is a signatory of the International Criminal Court Statute, and the peace process is being basically put together with guarantees from the government of Norway, which means that it has to abide by international humanitarian law. And so nowadays, you can't just have a blanket amnesty and give people political posts, even if you wanted to. So that was a major issue. And what's been positive about this political participation agreement is that they actually came up with several compromises on, given that that can't happen, what could it potentially look like? That would make it favorable enough for the FARC to demobilize and still incentivize them to demobilize, but at the same time not break all of the legal ramifications required or basically lose Colombian society's complete respect on the part of the
government. So FARC leaders are going to have to face some justice for human rights.
Well, what is being proposed right now in terms of political participation is that first there is a multi-party commission that develops an opposition statute. A big problem in Colombian history for many years has been that every time there was a peace negotiations with an insurgency group or with illegal armed group, that there would be reprisals taking place shortly after they've demobilized. And so, and that political opposition leaders also had great disadvantages when they tried to enter the political stage in multiple ways. So the first thing that's going to do is to try and turn that around and give some guarantee that a viable political opposition can exist without being persecuted and also has a chance of actually having a voice in Colombian politics. So, for example, the agreement that the FARC and the Colombian government stated that they agreed to includes access to media for political movements, creating these councils for reconciliation and coexistence in multiple parts of the country that would guarantee during elections that there'll be more citizen oversight and transparency. Also, that some of the obstacles that impede the formation of political parties are removed. And perhaps the most controversial one point is that there be these temporary special peace districts. Basically, the idea is that there would be zones, and it's not quite clear exactly what mechanism will look like on the ground, but the basic idea that there'll be zones of the country that would be areas where the FARC had de facto control or who had some control would have their own legislators in the House of Representatives. And so in many ways, this is a huge compromise to what the FARC's position has been versus what Colombian society will accept. And it's a really big step forward. That said, the issue of transitional justice, which was supposed to be the agenda item they're discussing now, has been pushed back because that's the thorniest issue. We don't know what kind of transitional justice mechanism is going to be put in place. We don't know how Colombia is going to reconcile the need for peace with a guarantee of justice to guarantee that there are no repetition of war crimes committed. That is going to be perhaps the biggest and most controversial point, given that we are in a stage in global international law where amnesties, reduction of penalties are no longer something that's acceptable in peace processes.
The two points that have not been negotiated, drug policy, judicial transition, are there other points?
Well, there is a general agreement in terms of how the agreement will be implemented, which I think is probably not a real point. The two big points that require further negotiation really are the drug policy and the transitional justice points. And with drug policy, we think that the Colombian government and the FARC are likely to be able to reach some kind of consensus because they both see that there have been limitations and problems with the aerial fumigation program, mostly funded by the U.S., although Colombia supports its fair share of it as well. And there is a general need to find other solutions to the drug problem. Perhaps what Colombia and the FARC agree to is going to come head-to-head with what the U.S. will or will not accept.
Because of the peace process, do you think that this strengthens Santos in front of the Colombian electorate?
I think that it strengthens him in front of the majority of Colombians. I think that it poses more of a problem for him among the some of the elites that are basically linked to businesses and sectors of the society that, in a sense, are winning a lot of money because the war is taking place. And for them, it is advantageous to have a war continue to take place. By this, I'm talking about many of the extractive industries that are able to operate in legally sort of vacuous ways because of the cover of the war in certain areas.
And that's what I've had Colombians tell me, mm-hmm. that the reason that this war has gone on for 50 years is because people are making money off of this situation. They want to see this continue.
Yes. And also there are sectors of the Colombian armed forces who feel that, you know, they've weakened the FARC and who feel like it's, you know, in some way winnable militarily, although that's questionable. And who would like it to continue in that vein. However, I would also add that if you look at the families of the soldiers and the general population, in the past year, since the peace process has been unfolding, at least 32 people have been kidnapped by the FARC. Not all civilians, a mix, mostly non-civilians. And so the impact of the war on those military families, on the security forces, is huge. And so I think that the overriding sentiment of most Colombians would be for peace. I just think that some of the most powerful folks who are making a lot of money off of the conflict are likely to not want to have Santos in power because it'd be better for them to have an Uribe candidate who's going to just further their economic goals.
Thank you so much, Ximena Sanchez of the Washington Office on Latin America. Wola, our guest today on Latin Pulse.
Great.
Latin Pulse is available in various locations on the web, including iTunes, Facebook, and MusicaQ. You can also find us inside the Brazilian online game, Mini Mundos. If you'd like to comment on this program, you may leave us a message online via SoundCloud, or you may write us via email. You can find us at latinpulse@gmx.com. That's latinpulse, all one word, @gmx.com. To see the Latin Pulse archives of video programs on Latin America, you can check out Link TV's website, www.linktv.org, and then /Latin Pulse, also all one word. That's www.linktv.org/Latin Pulse. Thanks for joining us this week on Latin Pulse. For our entire team, associate producer Megan Ackhamel and announcer Victor Kilo, I'm Rick Rockwell. Escúchenos otra vez. Gracias por su tiempo.
Latin Pulse is produced in Washington, D.C. at American University's School of Communication and with the support of Link TV. Theme music provided by Link TV and additional music from Canary Productions and Bath Time Music Publishing. This program is copyright 2013, Las Rocas Productions.